Next customer, please.
Hello, how you doing, mate? Can I have a birthday McFlurry for my best friend, please?
Birthday isn't a flavour.
Okay, two Smarties, please. What do you want?
Don't ask him.
Why not?
We don't have to feed him. We just need to take care of him until Mr. K calls.
After eight, please.
Do you do after eight?
No, that promotion ended months ago.
Okay, they don't have after eight.
What?
Yeah, it's a promotion thing. It's ended.
Ask again.
No, don't ask again. Don't.
Are you sure about the after eight?
Listen to me, mate. You're not hearing me. I can't make you an after eight McFlurry if I literally don't have the after eight stuff.
Could you try improvising?
I haven't done it!
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 315 for the week of August 10th, 2020! I am discontinued McFlurry flavor David Tekel, and I'm here with Blood Orange Glaze Sarah D. Bunting.
Thank you. Forget everything you know about the human spider.
And crooked financial advisor Tara Ariano.
I'm not Claire. Welcome to Extra Hot.
Yes, Great. Welcome.
Punchy edition. Unfortunately, although we announced last week that Will Ellis would be joining us, we did try. We had a hardware catastrophe. It did not work out for him to be on the podcast right now. We will have him back in the future when his student loans come through and he's able to upgrade his computer. But we three co-hosts are here for you. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Hello, Dave.
Hi.
That's what I like about Texas.
Dave's real sleepy.
Dave and I are very punchy, and Tara is going to punch both of us.
I rolled over at 3 a.m. Dave was awake on his phone. He, to my knowledge, did not sleep again at all until I came out about 10 minutes ago and saw he was asleep on the couch. So I think he's gotten about 20 minutes of sleep, probably.
Sounds about right.
Anyway, our topic today is
Hitmen.
Hitmen. This is a new show that's from Sky UK. It's been brought over to America.
Yep,
on
that's where
Peacock.
We are.
Peacock. The plot summary is as follows. Mel Giedroyc. I practiced before we started. Still screwed it up. And Sue Perkins. Longtime comedy partners and former Great British Bake Off co-hosts play Jamie and Fran, the titular hitmen, contracted by an unseen Mr. K to take out his various enemies, played by a different stunt cast British character actor in each episode. It's a challenging job, plus they're kind of daffy, so they get into comedic scrapes. All six episodes have dropped on Peacock, so the discussion may go past events in the first one. But in terms of whether we're going to spoil it, I got a text last week from past and future guest of the show, Dave Chen, who wanted to know, is Frayed worth watching? I appreciate your spoiler warnings, but I would also just like to know, did you like it or not? So why don't we just start there? Did we like it or not? Dave, did you like Hitmen or not?
The first scene started out very promising. I thought mm-hmm. it was the exact tone I wanted out of this, but then it softened and it never really hardened up again. So it is okay.
Yeah.
It is not great. I can't really say it's worth your time.
Yeah.
It is the kind of show that somebody's elderly mother might go, ooh, but nobody else would.
Yeah. I would say broadly speaking,
or not enough teeth.
Yeah. I think it's fine. It's the kind of thing that we might think was a very clever British import like 20 years ago.
Yep.
But I think now we expect more from TV comedy, and we can get into the ways that for me, it didn't quite hit the mark in case people actually do want to dip after we give our sort of overarching advice on whether to watch it. Sarah, what did you think?
I liked it a lot, but it's just one of those, I think we need a shorthand for this because it's not quite hotel TV, but mm-hmm. it's like, because I was obliged to watch it, I felt not beleaguered by it. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed seeing them again. There were some good lines in it to see Claire again.
Yeah, she's in episode two.
Was delightful. She was very funny. Jason Watkins is really good as the whatever special guest kidnappy in the first episode, mm-hmm. but it's like, now that I have completed the number of episodes that I have watched, I don't need to watch the remainder, mm-hmm. and I don't need to watch a season two. Like, I'm content for it to exist, but you know, I'm content for it to exist. It doesn't need me
right
anymore.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at. It doesn't offend me that it exists. I'm not mad at it, but I, you know, I don't need to keep watching it either. So now I think we can get into the plot a little, where relevant or where we even can, because to me it felt a bit like they came up with the premise and then they didn't bother spending any time on the story. Like, I think there's a way that that could have worked. Like, if it had just been a 10-minute show with Mel and Sue having ridiculous conversations in their van, occasionally involving their quarry of the week, that would have been a funny idea. And then at the end, they kill him. But it's not that either, you know?
Well, and I think it also is struggling with the actual hitman aspect mm-hmm. of it. Like, it needs to either be much darker and more willing to show these beloved, but as far as most viewers in the States know, like, associated with this gentle to in the extreme mm-hmm. and, you know, proper property, that they need to, like, they're afraid to really make it dark. And yet there are these, like, tussles and people do get killed. There's also barfing. Can we not import a Joe's Buncey here?
Yeah, it was full of fish paste and stuff because, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I think they need to lean into that harder or be much more abbreviated. Like, there's sort of a little trick where at the end of each episode, they kind of cut away right before something fatal happens. But mm-hmm. then during the episode, they don't necessarily do that. And it's like, do you want them to be hitmen or not? Because if you're really uncomfortable with these particular, like, branded performers doing this, don't make them hitmen. Make them cable guys. I don't care.
Right.
Something else where they're sitting around in a van.
Yeah, I wanted it to be darker based on the premise they set up. I thought it would have been better if it was comedically darker, but just darker in general, I think would have worked too, especially for your expectations for these two. Like, if they delivered Miami Blues with laughs, I would have been behind.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Something sort of proto Tarantino-ish, but with these two would have worked. And that could have been like half an hour. That also could have been 10 minutes too. They just sort of split the difference in the worst way. Like, they were, as Sarah said, yeah, not quite adventurous enough to really go bonkers, and as a result it just feels like the dial went up to 7.
Yeah,
wanted to crank it all the way up. And
yeah, if that,
and like, it was sometimes funny. Like, usually the funny stuff was at the end, and it was just the editing, like the actual like interactions between them and their victim each week were like okay, but it wasn't like really funny. And I think they thought that these two just being in a hitman situation might have been like comedy enough, or that would carry them further than it did. But like, I immediately after the first episode was like, okay, like that was okay. Let's see what else happens. And like, nothing else new really happens. It's sort of like the same, you know, the situations are different, but I felt like each episode was totally interchangeable with any other episode. Like, mm-hmm. nothing really happens. At least in the first four episodes, that I thought was anything special. I couldn't tell you which was episode 1, 2, 3, or 4.
There's definitely no heightening through the season from what we saw, for sure. Yeah,
that's fine, but mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I had a question about the other hitman pair that they occasionally interact with.
Yeah, Liz and Charles.
Which is, did anyone else wish the show were about them, kind of?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I thought the other Liz, I thought, was not a very good actor.
No.
I thought Charles was funny, but I did think
I like Charles.
I thought the problem with every time they came in is that the comic chemistry between Mel and Sue is great, obviously, because they've been comedy partners like literally since they were undergrads. But it felt like any time they were acting opposite anyone else, it really got bogged down and felt very sluggish and flabby to me. They're like, it just felt like it lost the spark whenever anyone else came in the scene.
Yeah, like they knew how to write those two, but they didn't know how to write those two in relation to other people. Yeah, I agree. It was a lesser beast when that happened, for sure.
Yeah, like the premise with Liz, the other assassin, is that Mel has Sue, whose name is Fran in the show, has a crush on her, and which is a funny idea. But then it's like, you don't buy it. Like, she's doing what she can, I guess. But it's like, I didn't feel like the acting was carrying that concept. And the other thing is that after the show had introduced them and we see that they're like the cool assassin team that's getting sent on the more dramatic aliasy sort of missions, like, I think that's what you're getting at, Sarah. I thought the point was going to be to contrast them with Fran and Jamie and how, you know, Liz and Charles can get away with what they that Fran and Jamie get away with being frumpy hitmen because no one suspects them because they just look like middle-aged women.
Well, yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, they're going to do something with that over the season. Like, we'll see how they capture people because no one thinks that anything is amiss. And then every episode starts with they've already got whoever they're getting.
Yeah.
And that's another opportunity that's squandered, I thought.
Yeah. That there could be this whole like world of London hitmen, like processy part that they're overlooking, that it's like, okay, well, at HQ, like, is it just these two teams in town or are there other teams? Can this be a season long like rivalry build that ends in some kind of like, I don't know, 1,000 Knives dance off? Here's me giving these ideas away for season two, which I won't be watching because they were sort of content to have it be this not all that dark, not all that different thing that they already do, and they do it well. But it's like there were some gross point blank directions this could have gone, and they chose not to go there, as far as I know. And again, won't be finding out.
I feel like part of the problem is they never reframe the situation that those two are in. Like, we watched a movie a couple of months ago called The Gentleman, a Guy Ritchie gangster movie set in London. And I felt like if they did something
about the Buffy villains, awesome.
They did something more like that, where you actually see Mr. K and he is a part of it, and you sort of see the organization and that sort of like, you know, they dip in and out of that, and that could be part of the storyline. So they have an opportunity to take the camera off them all the time, because I feel like it was also part like strain. They were always on, and it felt at sometimes they ran out of material for them to really do per episode. Like, those episodes felt a little thin, each one. Mm-hmm. So I felt like even if they just took a step back and like, what are these two hitmen's place in this criminal organization, and then what can we do with that criminal organization to make the whole show more interesting? That's why it reminded me of The Gentleman, because the Gentleman's like, you know, he's got the boss is Matthew McConaughey, and one of the enforcers is Charlie, what's his nuts?
Hunnam.
And there's like a very, like, if you've seen one Guy Ritchie gangster film, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's just a bunch of caricatures, but they're fun to watch together because they're so loud and crazy. And Hitmen doesn't give much of an opportunity for that bounce.
Yeah.
And I feel like because of that, no bounce, it's a little flat.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it agree. We all agree. I do feel like the edgy premise is supposed to allow Mel and Sue to stretch, as we've said, but like the average Bake Off fan even is going to be really put off by it. So this sort of feels like a show for no one kind of.
Yeah.
Too bad, because, you know, they deserve better, I think.
Bom, bom. So great. It's time to go around the dial.
Stop,
Dara.
I and Dave watched An American Pickle, the new movie on HBO Max. This is written by Simon Rich, who created Man Seeking Woman and was also a longtime SNL writer. It stars Seth Rogen and Seth Rogen. The premise is Herschel Greenbaum is an immigrant from Russia who is trying to live his American dream with his wife, Sarah, who's played by Sarah Snook from Succession. And then one day he's working his job at a pickle factory where his job is to catch rats and kill them for a nickel apiece, or a nickel a dozen, I forget, some ridiculously tiny amount of money. when he's suddenly set upon by way too many rats and falls off a catwalk into a brining barrel. And then right after that happens, which no one notices, they cover up the barrel because the factory has been condemned. And so 100 years later, some kids are flying a drone. They fly their drone into this place, which is like on the waterfront in Brooklyn and somehow has not been turned into loft apartments already. But anyway, they go in.
And you lost me.
They pull the cover off of the thing. Herschel somehow miraculously is still alive. He has been pickled all of this time. So they have a very funny bit where he's being studied by, you know, scientists and stuff. And they were like, and have a press conference where they're trying to, how did this happen? And they're like, Herschel is narrating this. They said the scientists had an explanation. It completely satisfied everyone. It's like exactly what you want. Like, who cares? This is the idea of, like, you know, a guy got pickled. It's fine. So what happens is they, of course, everyone he ever knew is already dead, but they trace his DNA and find out he has a great-grandson, whose name is Ben. He's also played by Seth Rogen, who he lives in Brooklyn, and they put them together. And so he goes to live with him for a while and they clash. So Seth Rogen was on Deezus and Mero this week saying the idea of the story was that Simon Rich saw a photo of his great-grandfather and thought that if they had met when they were the same age, his great-grandfather would hate him and maybe also kick his ass. So that's what we kind of get here. Herschel's great-grandson, this Ben, has had a comfortable life, hasn't had to struggle like Herschel did. He's been a freelance mobile app developer for the past 5 years. So even though no money figures are thrown around, they just say his late father was an accountant. I'm going to guess he was a mob accountant if Ben has been living off his estate without any other apparent means of support for that long. But he's also supposed to read as extraordinarily meek, which to me, it just seemed like Seth Rogen playing this role extremely Canadianly, which if you don't know, Seth Rogen is Canadian. We claim him. The app he's been developing, which is called Boop Bop, is for scanning barcodes on products so you can find out how ethical they are based on a variety of metrics. And I can't tell how sly Simon Rich is being with this. As the phrase goes, there is no ethical consumption under capitalism. And later, Herschel starts his own pickle business using salvaged materials, which on one level is very ethical and also very environmentally sound. But then he runs into issues with the health department, and someone suggests to him that he hire interns to help him scale up. And when they describe what an intern is, Herschel is like, you mean slaves? And they're like, no, but kind of yes. So... I'm on the fence about how intentional it is for the movie to show Herschel essentially reproducing early 20th century American immigrant entrepreneurship in our day as a critique of exploitative labor practices, but it's portraying them satirically, so I guess it qualifies. But anyway, there are some movies that have been released to streaming platforms during this time that were clearly supposed to be in theaters. Greyhound, for example, which we watched on Apple TV Plus, which, by the way, snooze, don't watch it. It's super duper boring. But
boat.
Yeah.
Boat.
Clearly, when you watch that one, you can tell from the scale of it.
It's, boat!
It was supposed to be on a big screen. This one has a small canvas and a small cast. Very small. Like, Ben's loneliness is a plot point, but also, like, they did not cast one friend for him. Or if they did, like, that friend got cut. So it doesn't feel like it's constricted in, you know, the home viewing format. There's some dumb stuff about three quarters of the way through, but where Herschel has to learn about cancel culture, which I could have done without, although it makes sense in context, but it's also a taste of modernity, which, blech. But overall, I thought it was a sweet, weird family story and a very pleasant way to spend a couple hours. Dave, you also watched it.
Best movie of the year, A New American Vlasic.
No middle ground with Dave Cole.
Wow. What did you actually think? You liked it.
I thought it was good. I'm going to make it the bread and butter of my...
Oh, my God.
Oh. You dill hole.
It was okay.
I thought it was cute.
It was okay.
It's cute.
Yeah. Like a lot of those Seth Rogen movies, mm-hmm. you like, he never knocks it out of the park.
Well, but he it's didn't always write it, but yes.
Okay. But all his movies that he's in, I feel like they're all sort of like enjoyable in the moment, not something I would buy for my collection.
Oh, no.
You
no.
know, and this is just like another one of those. It was fine.
All right. Well, I have a plug for my own stuff that I will mention later on in this segment. So to plug someone else, past and future guest, excuse me, Dave Roth and several of his former colleagues all resigned en masse from Deadspin last fall, as you may have read about. They are relaunching a new sports blog called Defector next month in September. It's going to be entirely reader supported, and you should.
I'm so excited.
I know. I don't even care about sports, but I like Dave and I like their other writing about other topics, which is part of the reason that they all had to, you know, ethically feel like they had to resign en masse.
Yeah. Why don't you stick to sports?
Exactly.
Why don't you suck a dick?
The shitheads who bought out the former Gawker properties were like, quit putting politics in it. It's like, well, politics is kind of in everything. So anyway, you can support them and their mission by going to defector.com and signing up for this. And this is, I hope, a new paradigm for how media can work, even in a time when there may not be products that want to advertise on websites, or a time when there are no products that exist. So we'll link them in the show notes too, but defector.com, and there's going to be podcasts as well. So this is great news for media and great news for Dave and for you.
Sarity Bunting.
Speaking of sports, I don't know why I'm always the one who's like, here's this football show. Like, it's one of three sports I could not care any less about if I were asleep, which I soon will be. But Hard Knocks is back on HBO. That, of course, is the long-running show about NFL preseason football and all the sort of things that go on behind the scenes, scrambling to get ready for the season in a, you know, gigantic industry and what is really America's actual national pastime. But this season, which was supposed to be like, hey, we're following two teams now because they're sharing this 70,000 seat stadium. Well, they're not sharing it with any fans this year because COVID. But this is actually quite a compelling watch, even if you don't care about sports, because first of all, you're seeing like on a day-to-day basis, and it is filmed, you know, like days and weeks before it airs. You're seeing how pro sports are dealing with COVID prevention protocols or not dealing with it. You're seeing how not important, but like you're seeing how the like capitalist drive basically to keep this industry and the myriad other industries that feed into it, mostly wrongly and corruptly, alive, are trying to keep, they just can't handle the idea of a shutdown. There's also recent protests over racial injustice that are going to be not so much in the first episode, but that's going to be a conversation in the show going forward. So this is an interesting, like, it's sad that a show about the NFL is kind of a slice of American life, but it is. And I think it's instructive, but it's also narrated with, I'm starting to think, ironic gravitas at this point by my friend and yours, Leah Schreiber.
Uh-huh.
There's apparently like a number of videos on YouTube of sports, like commentary shows doing challenges where they just throw up like some video of a dog catching a frisbee and you have to do your best Hard Knocks Schreiber voiceover for it. It's pretty fun. If you're feeling down, that's a good way to pass the time.
Nice.
But yeah, Hard Knocks, even as I always say about these football shows that I apparently am just going to be recommending, just call me Gridiron Buncey. Please don't do that. It's about more than the sport. It's about the times that we're living in. And it's like a rapid turnaround documentary of that in addition. So Hard Knocks is on HBO and you should find it on HBO Max if you figured out how to work HBO Max. Which you might not have. That's okay. They made it difficult. For my plugs, I have a whole bunch of stuff up at Primetimer on the Crimetimer tip, including reviews of Surviving Jeffrey Epstein and Yusuf Hawkins' Storm Over Brooklyn. I thought they were both excellent. Spoiler. And we will also link to Mr. Joe Reed's Smooth Joey Apollo's write-up of this season of Hard Knocks, because that might explain better than Sleepy Bunsy can why you should watch the show.
Nice.
All right. So a couple of weeks ago, we watched Star Trek Lower Decks, not Below Deck. That's a different thing.
That is
Star Trek
thing.
Lower Decks.
I'd yep. watch that.
Which has since been released on CBS All Access.
Yeah.
All of them, or are they doing?
No, they're doing one a week.
Doing two, a
two. Okay. Just the premiere has gone up so far.
So this is the animated Star Trek show. Kind of. It's a weird animal because it's like it's not bad. It has some laughs. It's not great. The problem with Star Trek Lower Decks is that it is released on the heels of Harley Quinn, which does it so much better. Like.
Yes, which we should say is now on HBO Max.
Yeah, they finally released it officially.
So, and I've seen on Twitter so many people that are like, wow, everyone was right. The show is great. And yeah, it is.
It is. So, you know, by comparison, you know, it suffers. But they made a Star Trek show that doesn't go too in the weeds on Star Trek stuff. Like, it's accessible if you don't really know too much about Star Trek, except everybody wears a different color uniform and there's spaceships and they can go real fast. And sometimes there's green aliens and stuff like that. Like, it's not hard Trek. It's very soft.
Right. The premise is it's a ship that does second contact. So they're not even doing the fun discovery stuff. They're like following up to
it's
be
B-team.
Like, here's some stuff that you will need for farming. Or
yeah. Whatever. And the cast of characters is like the B team. On the B team ship, they're the at the bottom of the ladder, and it's sort of a workplace comedy, really. And I felt like they could have been more daring. You know, that's the problem. Like after watching two seasons of Harley Quinn, is like that show was so daring in comparison to this one. Feels kind of flat. Although this one is obviously for younger audience as well. So, you know, you take that into consideration. There's a couple things. There was one moment where they show a Starfleet general falling off a stage exactly like Kelsey Grammer did. So I immediately went on the Wikipedia to look up the character name that Kelsey Grammer played on Next Generation, because I thought that would be a funny in-joke if that was the Kelsey Grammer character from Next Generation falling. No, not the character.
Well, I bet it was in the original draft and that someone up the chain was like, you have to change that. It's too mean.
Maybe, but then like the rest of the show doesn't really have, like, it's not super Easter egg-y. It's got some stuff, obviously, but it doesn't have that sort of reference hunt like some, you know, some other shows might. I would like to think that was the case because that would have been a funny piece of business, but for whatever reason that didn't happen. So the other thing that I find interesting is, it's not a canon show, obviously, but the way people now are trained to think about universes and franchises when everything has to be part of the whole, you know, like now Star Wars since Disney, like everything they do is canon, you know, whether it's the comic book or a story in a video game or the TV shows and everything, and they all have to be part of the one story, a la Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I think there's a type of person that expects this show to be canon too, which is kind of funny to me that somehow this would be canon with all this goofy stuff going on. Yeah. Somehow they would try to marry it with everything else. It was very interesting when the MCU started to have such like an ambitious universe where there was supposed to be continuity between a lot of stuff. And now where I feel like it's flipped for me. Like, I just tell a story in a different way. Like an Iron Man where he's just like on vacation and he's just being like an archer character, right? You know, or something like that.
Yeah, but yes. Like, it's like after that Picard story came out where it's like the original idea was like he just lives in a French town and is doing a murder she wrote. It's like, why couldn't we have had that?
And I
mean, that would have been so much better.
There is something to be said about the cinematic universe and what that provides and what a rich universe you can then pick from and all the shorthand you can do because of that, so that, you know, you can just have a character slam in the first 5 minutes. You don't have to do all that backstory shit.
Yeah.
After the, you know, that stuff is good, but then it sort of hems you in on the sort of story and the sort of tone and stuff like that. I kind of felt like I wanted more of a, like, you know, the crazy Picard stuff going on too. So
yeah, I will say I was emailing about this with Andrew Cunningham from the Appointment Television podcast, who I'm sure we'll have on here eventually. But he was saying what he likes about this is that it doesn't feel like it, because the characters are all ensigns and they're so low in the rankings. Yeah. Like, it doesn't feel like this is a show that's going to be tempted to shoehorn them into the "we have to save the galaxy" plot. Yeah. Like, it's going to keep it on a small scale. And I agree with him that that's a lot of the appeal of this, that it's going to, as you say, be more of a workplace comedy where it's like just, you know, more banal annoyances about what it's like to work with people. So I said in my review, which we'll link to, that was my other plug, that it has early Futurama vibes, both in the sense of, like, it doesn't feel like it has totally gelled, but it got better over the four episodes that we watched.
Yeah.
So I think if you like Futurama, you'll like it.
Yeah, I think it's promising. And I felt like the more we watched, the better they did get. So even if you're sort of like not totally impressed by the first one or two episodes, it does steadily get better. But I feel like there's a lot of headroom for it to get even better still. So hopefully they'll keep on it. I fucking hate the opening credits of that show, though. They're terrible. The fonts, the fucking hand-drawn stuff, and like the really sort of like bespoke music. But it feels like they went on a sound library and just typed in Star Trek alike and found something. Like, it's just like a weird, like, there but not there music thing. And the credits are very slow, but whatever. The show's okay. Right here on the next EEHG on Friday, we are tying into the new Aussie import Five Bedrooms, and we're going to cast our own collection of TV characters who pool the resources to buy a house in which they will all try to live together. That's available to all supporters of our Patreon. That is patreon.com/extrahotgreat. Thank you, everybody, for your support. As little as $1, I believe, will get you 75 episodes of Extra, Extra Hot, Great, and counting.
Dang.
And then next week, right here on EHG Prime, we take a trip to Lovecraft Country with TVGuide.com senior editor Malcolm Venable. I read the novel recently. So
yeah.
I'm interested to see what they do with this TV show, because it doesn't, at first glance, seem seriesable in a satisfying way. It's very sort of episodic. And then on the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show, the next episode that will be released on Monday features friend of the show, Mark Blankenship.
Hey!
So if you enjoy Mark Blankenship, tune in to the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show for episode 105.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Taylor Cole of that very same Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show. He calls this topic World Leader Pretend, and he writes, with the great now on Hulu, what world leader from history is most in need of a prestige-y period set miniseries about them with a modern sensibility, and who would you cast in the role? Will actually was really excited about this one, so I had him send me his write-up for this. So I'll read this one first. And Will writes, I knew coming into this episode that part of my role here would be to temporarily increase this podcast's Pinko quotient. Bless you, Will. And I feel like I'm making good on that now by recommending that Mahershala Ali should star in a miniseries based on Burkina Faso's first president, Thomas Sankara. Also, given that Steve McQueen is directing an upcoming political miniseries called Small Axe, I believe he'd be a perfect choice for director. Sankara was a Marxist-Leninist who helped to usher in policies that increased vaccinations, increased literacy, increased women's rights, and fought back against devastating ecological damage that had been done to the land. He was also an anti-imperialist who fought against harmful foreign influence that robbed many African nations of their wealth. I think now would be the perfect time for this miniseries, as there seems to be an increasing acceptance of communist and socialist ideas and argumentation within the U.S. I also think it's really important to make legible the histories of various non-European iterations and creations of socialist and communist ideologies and practices, making this project right for right now. Could not agree more. Great suggestion. Thank you, absent Will Ellis. Sarah D. Bunting.
All right. First of all, Taylor S. Cole, I see your REM reference, and I appreciate it. second of all, I would love for Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which has already been an Emmy-winning TV movie in 2007, I believe. It won a ton of Emmys. I would like to see it be a gazillion-part documentary miniseries at some point. The book by Dee Brown turns 50 this year. It is essential reading. Go find it. Failing that, and since we are picking only a leader, I will pick Sitting Bull, whose visions inspired the Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho in their attack at the Greasy Grass River, aka Custer's Last Stand. They kicked every inch of American forces ass, and with good reason. Unfortunately, that did not end well. Sitting Bull later decamped to Canada. He had quite a life leading up to and away from Custer's Last Stand, including working in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show before he was martyred at Standing Rock. I would love to see a docuseries about him. I would love to see a scripted miniseries about him and that entire horrible time. As for casting it, I am not sure, but I am going to go with Zahn McLarnon, who I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly. Mm-hmm. He is from that same Lakota Nation, the Hunk Papa. He has been on Longmire. He has played Crazy Horse in various properties. He is at that age where he could be the 40s, but also close to 60, which is how old Sitting Bull was when he was killed. So that is my vote. But seriously, if you get nothing else out of this extra credit, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Read it. Nice. Tara.
Well, obviously, my first thought was a female president or prime minister, but all of them are generally pretty problematic or not from long ago enough to be fun, like the first and so far only female prime minister of Iceland, Vigdis Finnbogadottir, who seems great, but was in office starting in the 80s, and that didn't feel like long enough ago to be a period show. So I slightly cheated and went with not quite a world leader, but rather former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada. Ah. He was born in 1939, so any story about his early years would be a period piece. Any American politician is, of course, definitionally problematic, but grading on that curve, he was more okay than not. Some of the true and documented details of his life are already kind of scandalous and a little bit campy in the great model.
It's true.
His hometown was so tiny, it did not have a high school, but it did have 13 brothels, which his mother sometimes took in laundry from. The school that he did graduate from was called Basic High School, which is just amazing.
It was just in it was in Helvetica on the front. White brick, black letters.
No, I assumed it was like in computer language.
Like a dot matrix.
Like go to Basic High School.
I also get no name brand.
Sure. Yeah. When he was there, he was an amateur boxer. And if your period piece can't make homoerotic hay out of that, get out of show business. He also was formerly the chairman of the Nevada Gaming Commission. So glam casino vibes. Hello, literally. The yeah. Dick Smothers character in Martin Scorsese's Casino was based on him, apparently. Since retiring, Harry Reid has not shut up about UFOs. So I feel like a sighting or multiple sightings or maybe an abduction could easily be worked into his early origin story on this show. Based on his photo from when he was young, I'm going to cast Logan Lerman from The Perks of Being a Wallflower and the Percy Jackson movies on as my Harry Reid in Pinky, which apparently was his childhood nickname, which is the campiest fact of all. Dave.
I am going to go with former Roman emperor and future guest Caligula. I feel like nobody wants to touch it since the terrible, like, porn adjacent movie / erotic historical drama thing they did from 79 with Malcolm McDowell
and Helen Mirren, right?
Yeah,
written by Gore Vidal. It's got everything. Like, really, nobody's touched it since then. It's just like it's poison, I guess.
Well, certainly diseased, probably.
Sure. So here's some facts about Caligula, and you judge for yourself whether this would fly today or not. 4-year emperor, contemporary Seneca the Younger and other contemporaries of him describe him as an insane emperor who was self-absorbed, short-tempered, killed on a whim, and indulged in too much spending and sex. His insanity, though, is described as a personality trait that came through experience. He insisted senators worship him as a god. In response to Jewish riots in the empire, Caligula ordered statues of himself to be erected in the Temple of Jerusalem and to be worshipped by Jews. He was convinced by local governors not to do that, and he said he wasn't going to do that, but then the next day he turned around and did it anyways. He installed ministers and consuls of questionable talent, such as his horse.
Right.
Mocked his opponents with names like Venus for not having a manly enough voice. He was accused of liking some of his family members a little too much.
Uh-huh.
He was accused of misusing military might against the populace of the empire. He oversaw a precipitous drop in the economic fortunes of the empire. He oversaw a constant churn of government commissioners under him, like the transportation minister at the time. And by the way, the guy he called Venus eventually assassinated him. So don't call people names.
Venus
so given all those facts, I don't know how you can make this relevant to the audience in 2020, but we're going to give it a shot. Everybody died in Rome when they were like 23, so everybody is relatively young. So for a good old-fashioned weaselly guy, I'm going to go with Pete Campbell for my Caligula.
Sure.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Who has our winner? Why, it's me. They're rebooting CSI for a miniseries. I kind of like CSI when it first came out. I was really into it. It was something very different. I mean, we all make fun of it now with the, you know, the David Caruso glasses and all the zoomy, zoom, zoom, zoom computer effects of the early 2000s. But, you know, it was innovative in its own procedural kind of way. And they're going to get Gil Grissom back and Sarah Seidel, but whatever. But they're going to get Gil Grissom back for this. So I'm hopeful that it will be fun again. And if it's just a limited thing, they can do something a little more arky, so that would be interesting. So I'm into it. I wouldn't mind a little more CSI back in my life. So
yeah, same.
Sounds like Gil Grissom and Sarah and then others, and nobody else is coming back, at least right now. Although I don't know why they don't get Marge back.
But the people demand Lady Heather.
Yes.
Yeah.
Agreed. And loser of the week?
Well, I have an honorable mention for poor old Taskmaster. Our friend Dan Cassino was ranting about this last night. He's very upset. It was pulled from the CW's schedule after one episode. But the silver lining is that all episodes of season 8 are now available on the CW seed, which, you know, under other circumstances, you would have had to wait for them to air one at a time. So that's good. However, I think the original plan was that the CW was going to show season 8 and season 9, and none of the stories that I've read about this decision have said season 9 is ever going to air or come to the CW seed, so you'll have to fly to England to acquire those, cough. But my actual loser is Succession showrunner Jesse Armstrong, who is apparently learning nothing from the 500 times Tenet has announced a premiere date and then had to push it back, and is boldly stating that he hopes to start shooting season 3 of Succession in New York before Christmas. Like, yeah, I hope that too, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen, and maybe you should not say that. Like, it's definitely probably not going to. You're going to have to take it back. And what is with British writer-directors trying to play chicken with this pandemic is what I would like to know.
Speaking about things you'd like to know, do you know what time it is?
Time to play chicken.
Game time. Welcome back to Game Time. This is the second Game Time of the season. Our scores so far are Sarah D. Bunting with 1 point, Tara Ariano with 0 points, and Value Guess with 0 points. Playing for Value Guess, our very special extra credit and Game Time guest, Taylor Cole. Welcome, Taylor Cole.
Taylor Cole.
Hello, thank you. It's awesome to be here.
We are playing the second half of It's All Academic. It is time for It's All Academic second semester from Chris Billig, the Billig of Goods, and Dan Cassino.
Oh, I know that guy.
To remind you, this is how it works. I'm going to give you a bunch of information up front. I am going to give you the name of an academic journal. I am going to give you the title of an article in that academic journal and the year that article was published. You have to guess the TV show we're talking about. Another piece of information I'm going to give you is the premiere date of said TV. A lot of information going to get up front. If you can guess the TV show, hooray for you, 2 points. If you need a hint, I will read you an excerpt from the article.
Okay.
To remind you, Chris and Dan made this game, so I'd have to read a lot of stupid jargon, and they are jerks, and be prepared for a lot of mispronunciations.
We have a hard out, so we should probably forego equalizer challenge.
Sounds good to me. Okay. So let's get to it. Let's see who will be going first.
We will start with valued guests.
Looks like Taylor is up first, followed by Tara, and then Sarah. Are we ready to play? It's all academic second semester.
Yes.
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 Here we go, Taylor. From the journal Screen, it is Thighs and Whiskers, The Fascination of Blank. That article came out in 1985 about a show that premiered in 1980. Any guess what that is?
Thighs, like the part of your leg?
Like chicken thighs.
Okay. And whiskers.
Yes. Thighs and Whiskers, The Fascination of Blank.
Well, it's making me think Cats because of whiskers, but Cats is not a TV show.
And I'm going to say at this point, you get a guess at each of the stages, so you can fire out a freebie here.
Okay. I don't know, Moonlighting. I don't know where that came from.
Part of the power of this image, this magnum opus of masculinity, depends on the perception of both Thomas and Tom as regular guys.
Oh, this must be Magnum P.I.
That is good for 1 point.
Magnum P.I.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Tara.
Yes.
From Cogent Social Sciences in 2015.
Oh, no. Sounds very cromulent.
Manufacturing White Criminals, depictions of criminality and violence on blank. From a show that premiered in 1990.
Law and Order.
Good for two. Sarah D. Bunting, are you ready for your first one?
Not really, but let's do it.
The Journal of Popular Culture. 2019, this article was published. Okay. It is called Looking Through the Upside Down, Hyper Postmodernism and Transmediality in Blank.
Stranger Things?
2 points.
Nice.
Back to Mr. Cole, no relation. 2013 in Critical Studies in Media Communication. The article is called You Are Not Allowed to Talk About Production, Narration on and Off the Set of Blank. You are not allowed to talk about production, narration on and off the set of blank. And that show started in 2000.
Oh, okay. So my guess of Arrested Development is not true because that started in 2003. Narration. Scrubs?
In this autoethnographic account, I critically interrogate my experiences on and off the set of blank. Pulling from phenomenological theories of time and narrative, I investigate how members of the show's production, blank, viewers, and I performatively rendered gay identity in the immediate context of the program and its fan forums.
Whoa.
Yikes. I don't know why I'm thinking this, but I'm thinking Popular. Is that from 2000? No.
Show we're looking for, Big Brother.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Was not going to get that one.
Back to Tara.
Yep.
From 2019, from the Journal of Popular Culture again.
Uh-huh.
Modern Melodrama, How the Blank Updates the Sentimental Novel. This show debuted in 2014.
Sentimental Novel. It's not The Handmaid's Tale. I don't know. I need the hint.
Instead, the series moves towards a complex view of the Latina experience in America, with characters who move away from the stereotypical maid, nanny, sex box, thug roles presented in other popular shows.
Jane the Virgin.
Bye-bye. Back to Sarah D. Bunting. Journal of Popular Culture once again, this time from 2011. Diagnosing Drama, Blank Blind Casting, and the Politics of Representation. For a show that debuted in 2005. Diagnosing Drama, Blank, Blind Casting, and the Politics of Representation.
Grey's Anatomy?
Doing, doing. 2 points. Nope. 2 points. 2 points.
Got it.
Who only got an hour, less than an hour of sleep today? Me, Taylor Cole. Mm-hmm. Sociology of Religion is the journal. This article entitled Blank Fandom as a Religious Phenomenon was published in 94. It references a show debuted in 1966. Blank Fandom as a Religious Phenomenon.
I'm going to say Star Trek on this one, or Star Trek the Original Series, I suppose.
You are dead right. 2 points for Mr. Cole.
I was thinking Doctor Who. Yeah. I don't even know if that's the right year.
Tara.
Yeah.
2006 from the Journal of Popular Film and Television.
Yep.
Reading the ungraspable double-codedness of blank.
Mm.
Boy, that's hard to get through when you got half an hour of sleep in you.
Yep. About a show that premiered.
Oh, I'm sorry. In 1989.
Beauty and the Beast.
Reading the interplay between text, audience, and institutional context, this article critically examines the distinctiveness of blank. It explores how the animated series uses contextual strategies that are interesting to and challenging for both postmodern critical theory and the processes of interpretation, including existing critical writing on the program.
Animated series? Good God. 1989. Muppet Babies.
Anybody else want to take a crack at that one?
If it's 89, it's got to be The Simpsons, right?
It's got to be The Simpsons.
Of course it is.
Oof.
Sarity Bunting.
Yes.
Also from 2006, the journal is Health and Place. The title of this article is, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. Blank and the place of contemporary healthcare in fixing crises. Oh, and the show started in 94.
ER.
Correct. Two Tara.
Nope.
Two Taylor.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Too many T's.
Yep.
If only Tara's name was Zara. We wouldn't have made that mistake. Back to the game. Quarterly review of film and video, Taylor. Mm-hmm. 2016, this article was published. A truly captive audience. Blank and mid-century American television rooms. And television rooms is in quotes. A truly captive audience. Blank and mid-century American television rooms. From a show that debuted in 1959.
Oh. Ooh. Television rooms.
You were only 22 at the time.
Yes.
I was negative 31 at the time. I
okay.
am gonna. I will say No, it's too late for the Honeymooners, but I'm gonna say the Honeymooners.
Incorrect. Roughly an eighth of the entire series concerned the particular theme of people barricaded, stranded, or otherwise trapped in a room. The rooms themselves are varied. Sometimes characters find themselves within a space hovering miles above the Earth.
Twilight Zone?
Twilight Zone is correct. Now, Tara, it is your go.
Yes, sir.
2018 from the Jazz Research Journal.
Oh.
Yes. Appropriate response.
Homeland.
Staying Golden, The Politics of Gender, Sexuality, and Jazz in Blank, 1985.
Oh, God. So not Homeland. What's the show? When did the show premiere?
1985.
Oh, okay.
Jazz Research Journal.
Saint Elsewhere.
Saint Elsewhere is not correct.
Okay.
Talking to men who like jazz at weddings increases her sex drive and potentially cause her to cheat on her boyfriend. These, as well as other examples, illustrate how jazz organize non-heteropatriarchal forms of gender expression, e.g. genderqueer musicians.
Come on. Come on, Journal of Jazz, whatever it's called. is this Moonlighting?
Incorrect. Stay Golden.
Uh-huh. Oh,
the Golden Girls.
doy.
Oh.
All right, this will take us into our mid-game score break. This is for Sarah from 2019 in the European Journal of Media Studies. Dreading the Future, Narrative Dread in Blank and Contemporary Television. Let me say, this is on point for us.
Year.
The year is 2015, the show debuted.
Blank and Contemporary Television. Deutschland 83?
I like that guess.
The article proposes that the narrative dread differs from other similar responses through its distinct temporality and level of knowledge. Through a discussion of the series Blank, the article argues that narrative dread is particularly effectively elicited by the long-form narration that is typical of contemporary dramatic television series.
Handmaid's Tale?
No.
I don't know.
What character do we dread the future of? We talked about recently. The show we're talking about, Better Call Saul.
Oh.
All right. Time for a score break, please.
Okay. I am pulling up the rear with 3 points. Taylor Cole has 4 points. Sarah D. Bunting in the lead with 6 points.
All right. Let's get right back into it. This is for Mr. Taylor Cole from Women's Studies, 2007. Fembot Feminism, the Cyborg Body and Feminism Discourse in Blank. That show debuted in both 1976 and 2007.
Is this The Bionic Woman?
It is The Bionic Woman.
Yes.
Wow.
Nice. I was going to say, if you got this one wrong, you were misogynist. So good job.
Tara Ariano.
Yes.
From 2019... from the Australasian Journal of Popular Culture. The musical number as feminist intervention in Blank from a show that debuted 2015.
Why can't I remember any shows that debuted 5 years ago? I was writing about television at the time. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
There you go.
There you go. Sarah D. Bunting, from the journal Horror Studies, 2016. Thunder Without Rain, Fascist Masculinity in Blank. Blank debuted 2010.
And the thunder rolls.
Fascist Masculinity. The Walking Dead?
Walking Dead is correct. Nice pull. Dang.
Nice.
Back to Taylor. Taylor, your journal is Television and New Media from 2009. Blank, Articulations of National Identity in Television Format Adaptation. We're talking about a show that debuted 2005.
2005,
yes.
The Office?
The Office is correct.
Wow. Nice.
This is question 17 for Tara.
Okay.
Spread Eagle.
Journal of Sociolinguistics is back from our first game. Everybody's favorite.
Oh, hey, buddy.
This article is written in 2006. The Dark Arts of Good People, How Popular Culture Negotiates Spin in Blank. Blank having debuted in 1999.
89 or 99?
99.
The West Wing.
The West Wing, correct.
Nice.
Back to Sarah. New review of film and television studies. So, like, they had their splitters from the Journal of Television Studies. I'm like, this is the new review.
There was a rumble.
Yeah. Splitters 2012. A return to form. Post-masculine television drama and tragic heroes in the wake of Blank. 1999 again.
Of Blank, 1999. Young Americans.
This argument is developed by reading them in relation to early modern revenge tragedy. This suggests that ultimately they re-inscribe and reclaim for contemporary white masculinity the position of the anti-hero slash subject as constructed by canonical tragedy and defined in terms of the experience of existential crises. That's a mouthful. 1999.
The Sopranos?
Correct. The Sopranos was 1 point. That brings us to question. For one Mr. Taylor Cole, host of the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show, your journal entry is from Popular Communication from 2016. It is titled, Symbolic and Cued Immersion, Paratextual Framing Strategies on the Blank Experience Walking Tour. This show debuted in 1963 and 2005.
That's got to be Doctor Who, yes?
Got to be Doctor Who, and it is Doctor Who. Tara.
Yes.
2018 from the Howard Journal of Communication. Intersectionality of Race, Class, and Gender. The Complex Representation of Bipolar Disorder on Blank. Blank from 2015.
Being Mary Jane.
Dope! Blank provides an opportunity to examine the representation of mental illness through a major character. Through narrative analysis, the author argues that Blank represents a complex, sometimes problematic representation of bipolar disorder. This depiction provides the opportunity to explore the intersectionality of race, class, and gender. 2015.
This is us?
Empire.
Oh,
of
course. Oh. All right. We're getting towards the end of the game. This will be our last question before our second score break. It is for Sarah D. Bunting. The American Economic Review, 1995. A natural experiment in blank. This show debuted 1964. 1974, 1978, and 1984. Lots of information. A natural experiment.
Can I have the title again, please?
Yes. A natural experiment in blank.
Let's make a deal.
I like that guess. This paper uses blank as a natural experiment to analyze behavior under uncertainty and the ability of players to choose strategic best responses. The results suggest that while most players bet in a rational manner, the failure rate for choosing best responses increases as the betting problems grow more complex.
Well, it's not card sharks. Fuck. Price is Right.
Anybody?
No idea.
Jeopardy.
Oh,
damn it.
Natural experiment in Jeopardy.
Jeopardy.
All right, let's hear the scores, please, Tara.
Well, it's a very close game for some people. I have 7 points. Sarah has 9 points. Taylor has 10 points.
Everybody Ooh. Has one question left, so pressure is on. Taylor. With a 2-point answer, you could clinch today's game. Here is your last question. The journal is the Communications Review. The article is from 2010. Blank as post-feminist icon, the fetishizing of the independent working woman.
Okay. About a show that premiered.
In 1997.
Okay.
Thank you, Tara. Is this Ally McBeal?
Is it? It is.
He did. Whoa.
Good job.
All right, let's close it out, Tara.
Yep.
From 2012, from the Communications Review again.
Okay.
Back to back, TCRs. Mm-hmm. It takes a classless, heteronormative, utopian village. Mm. Blank and the Problem of Post-Feminism. Show debuted 2000.
Sex and... No, that's not it. That was earlier. Blank and the Problem of Feminism.
Yeah.
Shit.
It takes a classless, heteronormative, utopian village. Blank and the Problem of Post-Feminism.
Fuck.
Through an intersectional analysis of family narratives on blank, the author demonstrates how the program's utopian post-feminist ideology reflects a narrow vision of family that excludes the diverse body of feminisms today. The author identifies three intersecting narrative strategies as representative of the post-feminist effect on popular culture. Heteronormative sensibility, upward class mobility, and post-race relations.
God.
That is so many words for this show. 2000. Any idea?
None.
Anybody on the panel?
No.
Nope.
Village is an important clue on this one, I think. Because we're talking about Stars Hollow. We're talking about Gilmore Girls.
Oh, God.
Of course.
Sarah D. Bunting closing us out, Feminist Media Studies. This article is from the year 2020. It is titled, The Moment You Realize Somebody Wants Your Body. Neoliberalism, Mindfulness, and Female Embodiment in Blank. Blank debuted 2016. The moment you realize someone wants your body, that's in quotes.
The Prophet?
Tropes of female excess are peppered throughout the series, from the resurgence of a naked female torso statue to the dead and failing maternal body to the yoga and mindfulness particularly marketed at women.
Goop?
Naked female torso statue? Fleabag.
I don't know.
Oh, sorry.
Fleabag.
2016. All right, let's get the, I didn't know it was that long ago.
Let's get the official end of game regulation scores. Please start.
All right. I had 7 points. Sarah D. Bunting had 9 points. Taylor is our victor with 12 points.
Woo!
Well done.
Yay!
Thank you.
All right.
And it's a good thing because we forgot to say Steel Meals and he had 5.
So
by more. Valued guest.
Valued guest.
Good job, valued guest.
Real fast, before last time I was on Extra Hot Crate for a listener game time 4.5 years ago, I lost. So this feels like a nice bit of redemption.
Aww.
But on that game time, I played against two people named Chip and Eileen, who by total coincidence, I think, are the two of the contestants on this week's new episode of the Great American
Get
Pop Culture Quiz Show.
That's
amazing. Wow.
Time is a flat circle.
Indeed.
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Grade. We took on the Peacock import hitmen before going around the dial with stops at an American pickle. Star Trek, Hard Knocks. Thank you. And Star Trek Lower Decks. Look, guys, a lot of things happened this week to our show. Also, I'm working off about 2 minutes sleep.
Yep.
We did not have a canon this week, so nothing got inducted. So look forward to the Tyra episode in a future installment of Extra Hot. Great. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Taylor Cole was the winner of this week's game time from Chris and Dan. Next up, it's TV Roomies on Extra, Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, Lovecraft Country. Remember.
Listening.
I am David T. Cole, really looking forward to a nap, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Okay, but someone should write a paper on Muppet Babies.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Popping your tits in a laminator.
And guest game time player Taylor Cole.
Don't forget to hit subscribe, and we'll see you next week.
We'll see you next time right here on Next Talk. Great.
I guess I'm just saying that nobody's life works out as they planned. You know, everyone ends up doing stuff they're not proud of. And in the end, the most important thing is that the people who know you and accept you for who you are.
God, do you know what? For a guy that spent most of the day with a bag on his head, you are absolutely right.